Welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio, the program where we explore the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture. Now here is your host, the author of four books, including Be Yourself and Our Spiritual Evolution, Mark Gilbert.
Thank you, and welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio. I'm your host, Mark Gilbert, and today our show's entitled, Can We Get Our Governments to Solve Global Problems? A conversation with John Bunzel. Now, I just finished reading John's short briefing book. It's entitled Global Domestic Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Running a Diverse Planet. And as you could probably gather from that title, John probably believes not only that we can get our governments to solve global problems, but that we each as citizens play a key role in that process. Both in his book and on his website, simpol.org, which is S-I-M-P-O-L.org, he outlines a new way of looking at the topic of global governance. Now, I know there's a phrase that's charged with a lot of emotion for a lot of people, especially here in the United States. But I couldn't help but think as I was reading John's briefing book that what he describes is a possible method for moving our governments to the next step in their evolution. One that, to borrow integral philosopher Ken Wilber's words, transcends and includes our current governmental structure. The method is one that paints a picture of how our governments, as well as corporations, can retain their natural desire for autonomy, meeting their individual needs, while using other natural forces to assist humanity in moving to higher levels of cooperation so as to solve the essential global issues we're facing these days. For example, think of how the individual cells within complex animals at one time in a revolutionary past sought to retain their individual autonomy as a cell while simultaneously cooperating with other cells in order to evolve to higher life forms with more complex and specialized structures. What I see in John's model is something that's offering us the same next step or leap in our evolution, a way to keep our current governmental control and autonomy while seeking a higher way of cooperating with one another. This step is critical in my opinion, and I think in John's as well, as we'll get into it, is if we're really going to address global issues such as overcrowding, global warming, and so on, we really need to make that leap into the higher levels of our consciousness as humanity and to find new ways to seek cooperation, especially among our nation states. So here's a little bit of background on John. John Bunzel is a UK-based businessman who founded in 2000 the International Simultaneous Policy Organization, or ISPO. And he also launched the Simultaneous Policy, SIMPOL, campaign. Ever since the SIMPOL campaign started, John's been working tirelessly to reach out to citizens, activists, non-governmental organizations, politicians, and business people to raise both awareness and understanding of what global simultaneous policies could mean for humanity, prosperity, and peace. To those ends, John's authored three books, SIMPOL in 2001, Monetary Reform, Making It Happen, along with James Robertson in 2003, and People-Centered Global Governance, Making It Happen in 2009, as well as at the briefing book that I mentioned a moment ago. He's spoken at a couple of TEDx events, including one in Berlin, and the video of that one in Berlin is on his website. There he outlines the SIMPOL process we'll be talking about today. And the video of that, the link to that, is on the radio's website. So all of the resources, both John's website as well as his TEDx talk program, are all linked through the website for the Conscious Bridge Radio Show. So we invite you to check those out after you listen to today's conversation. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks very much for the invitation. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and one of the things that sort of, I always am curious when I talk to folks, is how did you get doing what you're doing? I mean, I was looking at your bio, and here you are, somebody, you also work in the textile industry, as I see or read online.
That's right. Yeah, and paper,
And then you take on this whole opportunity to try to bring governments into cooperation and bringing out simultaneous policy. What led you to taking this on?
Well, it was really just a kind of light bulb moment that just struck me. We were just having a kind of Sunday lunch with my family, and you know, I think the kids had been doing climate change at school, mm-hmm. and you know, I was just sort of doing the washing up afterwards, and my mum sort of turned around to me and said, well, you know, what would you do about the problem? You know, I just had this insight that solutions would have to happen global and simultaneously, because any nation that moves first on climate change to try and solve it is going to make its economy uncompetitive. And so there's a kind of first mover disadvantage. You know, anyone that moves first to tackle the problem will suffer a disadvantage. And so, of course, nobody wants to move. And that's why, you know, there's been very little progress on climate change. And so that's, I mean, I'll come back to the Paris Agreement at the end of last year, of course, but that's how the idea kind of came to me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I honor you for taking this on and bringing this opportunity to bring us to greater levels of cooperation to the world while still doing your day job as well, I guess.
Yes, that's right. Well, sort of part-time at the moment now.
You know, one of the things I noticed both in reading your briefing book as well as watching your TED Talk is that you equate the problem we have with our governments in terms of why they can't seem to address some of these major global challenges. You equate them to the common prisoner's dilemma that's most people who are familiar with game theory are familiar with the prisoner's dilemma. And maybe you could very quickly just sort of launch why you see governments in this dilemma that they're in that leads them to not being able to institute policies that would be for the greater good of the planet.
Well, it's in a word, Mark, it's globalization. I mean, under globalization, the difference between globalization and the pre-globalization era is that pre-globalization, capital, corporations, communications were much more nationally based. They, you know, capital could not easily move across national borders. Corporations could not easily move their domiciles or operations across national borders. But today, under globalization, we live in a global economy. So, you know, capital, corporations, investment markets are global, and yet governance is still stuck back at the national level. And it's that mismatch between a global economy and national governance which creates the problems. If you look at, for example, just look at the Panama files that have just been leaked. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you'll have heard about it.
Right.
And, you know, all the tax avoidance and tax evasion and money laundering this is just gives you an eye open into the way the global economy works these days. And there is a prisoner's dilemma, because any nation that for example, on corporation tax, if you increase your corporation tax, you're going to lose business to someone else. And so the result is that there's a race to the bottom. You know, rates of corporation tax around the world have been reducing over the last quarter of a century because nations are in a prisoner's dilemma. They're in a race to the bottom. And that means that governments have less and less revenue from corporate taxes, so they have to shift the tax burden onto individual citizens like you and me. Mm-hmm. And it also means they don't have the money to spend on public services and all the rest of it. And so this ability of whatever is globally mobile to outwit national governments means that the globally mobile, whether that's the mafia or crime syndicates or multinational corporations or the rich, they get an advantage because they get to evade tax, whereas the nationally rooted, like you and me, get lumbered. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, it's not surprising that the gap between rich and poor just keeps on getting wider and wider, whoever is in power, because it's not actually about politics or whether, you know, Republican or Democrat. It's a systemic issue. We have a global economy, but we only have national government. And that's the problem.
Yeah, so essentially what governments are faced with having to do is trying to create policies that balance meeting their own needs, keeping companies in their own territory so they can collect appropriate funds, et cetera, And if they try to raise the taxes, they'll leave to another country. And so it's a corporations basically doing what they need to do in terms of how they're structured, in terms of maximizing profits.
Following
their natural process, and governments doing the same, trying to maximize their resources as well and their income.
In a way, that's correct. But as a result, society and the environment are losing.
Exactly.
You know, because I'm a businessman, so I understand the way corporations are thinking. I mean, and you know, they are thinking, well, look, if we, you know, if you're Corporation X and you don't shift your profits to low tax jurisdictions, you're going to lose out to your competitors that do it. Mm-hmm. Right. So in a way, it's a systemic issue. You know, we can complain about it being unethical and unfair, but at the end of the day, they're in a competitive market, and if all the while governments fear to regulate because they don't want to lose business to other jurisdictions, you've got this double-sided prisoner's dilemma that you know, between governments on the one side and corporations on the other. Neither you know, governments can't move, and corporations just keep on, you know, competing with each other to pay less and less tax. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we're all going to lose out.
Yeah, I think this is what you call or describe as destructive global competition. And so your solution really is something called the SIMPOL process, or the simultaneous policy process. How do you envision that working?
Yeah, I mean, SIMPOL is basically, there's three key elements to SIMPOL. The first is simultaneous implementation. It means, firstly, that to break the vicious circle of destructive global competition, all the sufficient nations need to implement the necessary regulations simultaneously, because if all the sufficient nations act together, everybody wins. The second element is that, and this is where actually the Paris Agreement on climate change comes in, the second element is that SIMPOL would contain multiple a sort of multi-issue agenda. One of the reasons that international summits routinely fail, or they fail to really produce the substantive results that we expect, is because they only deal with one single issue, like carbon emissions, for example. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that almost any single issue you care to think about, there will always be some nations that win on that issue and other nations that lose on it. And so the losers have no incentive to cooperate. So, for example, on carbon emissions, you know, China and the U.S. are by far the biggest emitters of carbon. They'd have the most cuts to make. They'd have the highest costs. You know, there is just simply no incentive for them to cooperate meaningfully. And so what we need to do, I think, is to have a multi-issue policy agenda, and SIMPOL would incorporate more than one issue, simply so that what nations may lose on one issue, they can gain on another. So, for example, if you had a global currency transactions tax, sometimes known as a Tobin tax, which could raise just a tiny fraction of a percent on all foreign currency transactions globally, you know, you would raise billions and billions and billions of dollars, and those billions could then be used to pay off the big losers on the climate part of the agreement. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that's easier said than done, but I think you get my drift. You know, right. Unless we mix two or more complementary issues together, you're never going to get substantive cooperation. Mm-hmm. And I think that in 5 years from now, I think that's what we're going to find with the Paris Agreement. In Paris, you know, the 189 nations agreed to this, what sounded like a great agreement. They were going to limit carbon emissions and so forth. But I think 5 years from now, we'll find that progress has been incredibly slow. Nothing much will have happened. Why won't it happen? Because of the prisoner's dilemma that all nations are still subject to. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the third aspect of SIMPOL is where the citizens come in. This is where citizens are absolutely critical, because the question is, how are we going to drive our governments to implement these multi-issue simultaneous policies? How are we actually going to get them to that point? Well, that's where you come in, because when you sign on for the SIMPOL campaign, basically you turn around to your political representatives, your congressmen or your senators, your members of parliament, and you say, you know what, in all future elections, I'm going to be voting, I'm going to be giving strong voting preference to politicians that have signed up to implement SimPoll alongside other governments, to the probable exclusion of those who haven't. Okay, so politicians that sign on to SimPoll and support the campaign and commit to implementing it alongside other governments, you know, get the chance of getting our votes, and if they don't sign up, they risk losing their seats to their competitors who have signed up.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, you've gotten some people signed up in the UK and a few other countries already.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting because in the UK, where we're sort of, it's more like we're kind of treating the UK as a kind of pilot test mark. So, you know, we're furthest advanced here. And at the last national elections we had last year, in May last year, we actually got over 600 candidates from all the main parties to sign up to SimPoll. And of those, 30 are now sitting MPs, members of Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of us that it got to do that was actually incredibly small, because if you think about it from a politician's point of view, if I think about it as a politician, I would be saying, okay, well, if I sign on to SimPoll as a politician, I don't actually have to implement this until all are sufficient other nations on board. So that's good, because I know that I won't have to make my country uncompetitive by doing this. I can wait until others are on board, because in a way I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I can also gain the advantage of all those citizens, supporters of SimPoll, who will, you know, are more likely to vote for me if I sign up to this.
Mm-hmm.
But if I fail to sign up to it and my competitor signed up to it, I could lose my seat.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you need an adequate number of people who are taking on the role of citizen advocate to contact their representatives.
Well, you do, Mark, but that number can actually be much smaller than you think, because very many parliamentary seats and even entire elections around the world, and I can remind you of the U.S. presidential election in 2000,
mm-hmm.
are actually won and lost on very tiny numbers of votes very often.
Yeah.
And so with SimPoll, you don't need the majority. You just need that critical number, which is the sort of difference between the two main competing parties. And we actually, you know, we actually prove that this works in a small scale. Here in the UK, I mean, we have what we call a first-past-the-post system, which mm-hmm. I think, you know, similar to what you have in the States. You know, whoever gets, you know, if you get one vote more than the other guy, you're elected to Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an electoral area here in the UK. We have a number of them which are marginal. I mean, one of them in the southwest of England, called Weston Supermare, I think it was the previous election, it was won on just about 100 votes. Okay. And in that constituency, it took just one of our supporters writing to the candidates, and it was like a domino effect. Once one of them signed up, all the others kind of had to follow, because they thought, crikey, you know, if I don't sign up, I could just lose my seat, or I could lose the opportunity to gaining the seat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the end of the day, they all signed up. In fact, well, nearly all, a minor candidate didn't sign up, but basically, even a month before the election, we knew we would have a Member of Parliament signed up for SimPoll. It didn't matter which candidate won, because we won, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a completely new way of doing electoral politics, but at the global level. So, you know, when you sign on to SimPoll, it's like having two votes rolled into one. When you sign on to the campaign, we immediately will inform your Member of Parliament or the candidates, if it's election time, all the candidates in your electoral area that you've signed on to SimPoll. That, if you like, is your global vote,
mm-hmm.
okay, because SimPoll deals only with global issues. But then when election day comes round, you get your regular national vote like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like having a global vote and a national vote.
Yeah.
And it's free. It's there already.
Now, I see you've set up a U.S. website, but are you just starting or launching into the...
We've just set up the website, but we don't actually really... And we have some supporters in the U.S., but we don't really have anyone there yet who has come forward to... who's really got this between their teeth, mm-hmm. and really wants to make something out of it. I mean, you know, for example, you know, I know you're associated, Mark, with the coffee party, mm-hmm. And it seems to me that something like Simpl could be the kind of thing that they might be quite interested in.
Yes,
so I think there's, you know, there's a lot, there's a constituency in the U.S. of reasonable people, the broad middle, who are fed up with this polarized sort of slanging match between, mm-hmm. you know, the Republicans and the Democrats, and who are looking for a sensible way forward. And of course, a lot of the reasons that there are problems, not only in the U.S. but elsewhere, are actually coming from the global level. You know, people often tend to blame, you know, one party or another, or one way of thinking or another. But a lot of these problems, whether it's mass migration, whether it's unemployment, whether it's, you know, the gap between rich and poor, these are all coming from the global level.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, they're coming from this gap that I mentioned before between a global economy and only national governance. Yes. And so I think, you know, people who can starting to see that will hopefully see Simpl as one way we can actually address those global issues, which cannot be done by national governments and you know, aren't being done by the UN or other global agencies.
Right. Now, just mention for our listeners that, you know, if as this conversation goes along and you're one of those people who wants to grab it by the teeth, so to speak, and run with it, part of our coffee party listeners, the website that John's talking about is on our radio program website. And so check out more of that. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. You know, one of the things, John, that when I was thinking about the pledge aspect of it, or going and seeking your politician to make this pledge, is that the U.S. has had a sort of a bad taste. Well, I'll say a bad taste for me in the whole area of politicians making binding pledges. There was an individual in the States called Grover Norquist. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him or not, but he was a fairly conservative individual who was very against governmental taxes.
Yes, I heard about this.
Yes. And he went around getting primarily everybody on the Republican side or the right wing side to sign a pledge that they would not vote for any tax increases. And of course, you know what that did is it painted the politicians into a corner. They signed these pledges, and Norquist and his band of supporters were very adamant in calling attention to any politician who broke the pledge. Yet what happened,
right.
A lot of times, obviously, if you're effectively operating a government, you need to take a look at the entire budget. And sometimes it's increasing income, and sometimes that's taxing. And when they took that off the table, that for a large constituency of the voting representatives, it forced us into some awkward moments. What would you say to people who would say, well, you know, that's just sort of like Grover Norquist and his pledges? How are your pledges different?
Well, there's two ways I'd like to answer that. The first one is that the Simpl pledge is different because it actually only becomes active if, and it's all based on simultaneous implementation. In other words, it only becomes valid as if and when all or sufficient nations agree to these policies.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it isn't unrealistic in the sense that I think you mean, Mark, is that, you know, you force a politician to sort of say that he's not going to do X, Y, Z, and then when he gets into power, he finds, well, actually, you know, I have to do this because otherwise it's just not going to work. With Simpl, it's a different situation because the whole basis of Simpl is simultaneous implementation because global issues cannot be solved without it. So I would say that the basis of the Simpl pledge is a realistic basis. That's the first point. The other answer I wanted to give you is that actually the pledge methodology or technology is actually quite effective. As you said with Norquist, he actually got was able to encourage politicians or coerce them, I don't know, but he certainly encouraged, you know, it was quite powerful. And so I think, you know, in a sense, it's a powerful technology, but it needs to be used sensibly and with a pledge that is actually realistic. And that is what we're trying to do with SimPol.
You know, and I think one other thing to maybe add to your answers is I'm sensing that the SimPol simultaneous policy is really only looking at those policies that are international, or I think you make the distinction between unilateral policies and simultaneous policies.
Exactly.
And for me, I was thinking, okay, ones that affect just my country and ones that have a broader based connection with the rest of the world.
And precisely.
So the policies that really a politician is pledging to support, or the process, is the ones that have a global coordinative necessity to them.
Absolutely.
Whereas it doesn't lock them into any of the positions that are pertinent for the individual country.
No, exactly. That's right. And this is the transcend and include that you mentioned earlier, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, transcend and include, it basically means leaving nations to get on with what they can get on with, but achieving international cooperation for those things that they can't get on with, but can only get on with other nations. So it makes a very clear, SimPol makes a very clear distinction between unilateral policies and simultaneous policies, and anything that is unilateral has nothing to do with SimPol. So we are only, you know, SimPol is a very specific tool designed for a very specific kind of policy, and it is only those policies that nations can't implement alone.
Mm-hmm. Maybe put you on the spot a little bit, but could you maybe give a brief example of something that you see might be, say, a simultaneous policy versus one that might be a unilateral, only within one country policy?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so for example, I mean, policies on climate change, policies on corporate taxation for multinational corporations, policies on financial market re-regulation, all of those sort of things would be simultaneous policies, because no nation can deal with these issues unless all or sufficient other nations also do it at the same time. A unilateral policy would be things like, would be anything that a nation can do on its own. So, I mean, anything from like health and education policy, capital punishment, abortion, I mean, you name it, any of those kind of issues have nothing to do whatever with SimPol, because they can very easily be done by an individual nation on its own. I mean, there are some areas, Mark, which would kind of overlap a little bit. So, for example, if you take climate change, a nation probably could reduce its emissions by kind of, I don't know, 10 or maybe 20% without causing itself a serious economic competitive disadvantage. And so, that portion, you know, that 10 or 15 or 20% reduction, you know, nations should carry on and do that now. They're able to do that now. But for the really big cuts that we all know are ultimately needed, that can only be done through international cooperation, and that's, again, where SimPol would come in. So, as I say, there are some policies that will kind of span the two, but it depends on the degree. You know, it depends on, if you're talking about a 5% cut in carbon emissions, well, that's a unilateral national issue. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about a 50% cut, then it's going to be an international issue.
Well, John, I got a lot more questions I want to get at, but we need to take a short break here.
Okay.
And, this is Mark Gilbert with Conscious Bridge Radio, and we're talking with John Bunzel, and our program today is Can We Get Our Governments to Solve Global Problems? And we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Debbie Lynn Molyneux, president of Coffee Party USA. I hope you're enjoying this program, which is part of the Coffee Party's radio network of shows. Have you ever wondered exactly what is the Coffee Party? Well, have you ever brought up the subject of politics and watched as people roll their eyes? Well, Coffee Party is an all-volunteer nonprofit to encourage respectful conversation around politics. we want people to connect with each other in a more meaningful way. Coffee Party supports reforms of our electoral, campaign finance, government accountability, and tax systems. We also promote cultural changes to address political disengagement, polarization, and misinformation. Won't you come join us? Check out our website and find out how you can get involved as a member and a volunteer of Coffee Party USA today. Help bring civility and reason back to our political process. Go to coffeepartyusa.com to find out more. That's coffeepartyusa.com. Thank you.
Hi, Mark Gilbert again. I hope you're enjoying this radio program. I invite you to also check out the Conscious Bridge website at www.consciousbridge.com or see the link on the radio program's website. There, I've been sharing my exploration of the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture for the past 6 years. You'll find descriptions and links of all four of my books, as well as years of articles, free audios, videos, listings, and links to numerous resources. And be sure and sign up for my newsletter as well. If you do, you'll get a free gift from me. All of this and a whole lot more at consciousbridge.com. Now back to our program. Welcome back. We're talking with John Bunzel. John is the coordinator of the SIMPOL process, the simultaneous policy implementation process. We're talking with him about a method by which we could, as citizens, encourage our governments to cooperate at higher levels and work towards solving global problems. You know, John, one of the things that, as I was reading through your book and your website and such, that came to my mind is that I recognize that here in the States, the anything that smacks of global governance has a natural...
I know what you're going to say.
It's got a natural knee-jerk reaction. It's already... Yeah. It's starting off in a hole to begin with. And, you know, I'm just wondering, how do you see this, the model, the simultaneous policy model being... totally different. How do you waylay the fears of people who say, oh, that's global governance and we're just giving away our rights to some powerful elite and we're losing control?
Yeah. Well, I think what you've got to understand is that, and this is where the distinction between unilateral policies and simultaneous policies is so important. It's that what I would say to those people is that if you want a reasonably just world, you want corporations to be taxed fairly, you want emissions to be cut so that you're not going to get forest fires and a ruinous climate and so forth, it's in your self-interest to cooperate. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know, so it's people understanding that there are some things where it's your self-interest not to cooperate and to compete, but there are other things where it's in your self-interest to cooperate, okay? Mm-hmm. And the whole point about SIMPOL is it's all about self-interest, but you need to make a distinction between those policies where nations should remain autonomous and it's in their interest to remain independent and autonomous, and those policies like the ones I mentioned earlier, carbon emissions and climate change and corporate taxes and so forth, where it is in each nation's self-interest to cooperate with other nations. Because otherwise, you won't get those policies implemented at all. So it's a question of distinguishing. I think part of the problem, Mark, is that people have a misunderstanding. They think that competition is all about self-interest and cooperation somehow is all about self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Rubbish. That's absolute rubbish. You know, cooperation is actually about self-interest as well. But it's a question of which policies or which issues you're talking about. Some issues you will want to keep your autonomy because that's in your best interest. Other issues, you will want to cooperate with others because that's in your best interest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I think you pointed
you
out.
You don't sound convinced.
Well, I think it's some of the listeners out there that maybe will need to be convinced. I tend to understand the point of really seeking cooperation. I was going to point out that I think it was in your book that I was just reading that, you know, when to actually make the leap from small states to larger nation states in our past as humanity, we had to learn how to collectively stop competing at a certain level and fighting with one another and start cooperating at a higher level. So our whole history, our evolutionary history as humanity is ripe with example after example. At the beginning of the program, I talked about cells moving into organisms, but your book talked about, you know, small states going into larger states. And what you're really looking at is trying to say, how can we use the natural forces that are in front of us that want to maintain their autonomy, but also recognize there's a greater calling, there's something higher that we can aspire to here. There are bigger issues that we need to address through bringing together ourselves in some sort of cooperative way that's beyond what we're currently doing. But, you know, there's a lot of people in the United States who have this, it's almost funny, and I guess, I know you're a student of spiral dynamics, and we could go down that path, but there's a lot of people here that are very resistant to anything that smacks of losing autonomy as America, as that, you know, there's the vision that we're the, you know, we're the great shining city on the hill, and, anything that says we now are cooperating with other people seems in their mind to take away from the greatness that they hold or lock on to as part of their DNA, so to speak.
No, I understand that, and that's you know, I understand it, but it's a lesson that we've all had to learn. Mm-hmm. And you know, the English, you know, no less than anyone else, you know, we had our empire and our sort of global autonomy and all the rest of it. But you know, at the end of the day, we end up realizing that we somehow have to coexist with everybody else, and actually, it's in our interests to do that. I mean, for those sort of extreme libertarians, and you know, I would recommend they read The Darwin Economy by Robert Frank. Okay. That's a great book which deals very directly with the libertarian argument and quite convincingly explains why it doesn't hold. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think you're beginning to see now with multi-level selection theory and the work of David Sloan Wilson, for example, and also Peter, there's a good book by Peter Turchin called Ultra Society, which is really starting to show that, you know, competition is just one half of the story. Cooperation is the other half. But, you know, competition has hogged the limelight, which is why people totally misunderstand that cooperation is also about self-interest. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thankfully, things are beginning to swing back the other way now, and the pendulum is beginning to come back towards a more balanced level where, in fact, competition and cooperation are both equally valid and necessary parts of life, mm-hmm. and each have their role to play. And, you know, one of our roles, I guess, as humans is to learn how to balance those two, but they are seriously out of balance at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and one of the issues I see too is that sometimes I think we've been burned in the past by certain leaders, and especially there's a sense in the States right now about the over influence of money and politics and corporate control of our government, such that one of the things that when people say, well, your process sounds good, John. I understand why we'd all want to simultaneously implement a policy, but where are those policies going to come from? Who actually is the
decides?
Yeah, who decides the policy that we're going to move towards simultaneously?
Yeah, well, not me. I can tell you that. Basically, we're doing this in two stages, Mark. First of all, the first stage is what I'm calling the political support. So that is what I described to you earlier. It's getting politicians to sign up in principle to this process. But once we've got sufficient, if we're lucky enough to get to the point where we have sufficient political support, then the policy side of it, you know, the question that you've just asked, what will the policies be, that then comes to the fore. Mm-hmm. And what I envisage there is that you will have citizens in each nation will be coming up with what for them are the top 10, say, most critical global issues, and what they think the correct policies would be to solve those issues. Mm-hmm. Within that process, you would apply what I call the subsidiarity criterion, so that only policies that are really need simultaneous implementation, only those ones could be selected. Anything else that's unilateral would not be permitted, because that is a national issue. Mm-hmm. So you would then have 100 to 200 odd different nations with different ideas. You then need to bring them together for a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Because there will be obviously different views. You know, people in Germany may think climate change is the biggest problem. People in Africa might think poverty reduction is the biggest global issue. So there's going to be a negotiation. Mm-hmm. And I'm under no illusions that that would be easy. And I have only really sketched out a possible sort of outlines of a process of how it might unfold. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have to understand, I think that what's important to understand about this process is that you need to see it against the backdrop of a worsening global situation. Because it's only when the water gets up round our necks, that's when the pressure for cooperation really is there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't got to that stage yet. But when we do get there, I think that what sounds like a very complicated and almost impossible process that I've just described could actually produce, you know, some really good results, because it's in everyone's interests, mm-hmm, to get to a solution and to get to the policies that we really need.
Yeah, you know, what you just described sounds very similar to some of the things the United Nations was doing as a lead up to the Sustainable Development Goals that they came out with last year. They had a whole process of getting input from individuals via website as to what the top goals were and what we should be working towards as global sustainable development goals. So I don't think it's necessarily an impossible task for us to coalesce around some top goals. I think that's a possibility. But I want to arc back to this anti-global governance point for a moment, because one of the things the United States has really been wrestling with for the last year or two is the whole TPP trade agreement.
Yeah.
It's Hillary Clinton's come out against it. She said she supported it. Now she doesn't. Bernie Sanders doesn't like it. Donald Trump's even spoken against it, too. So we've got three of the major presidential candidates who have come out against that, and a large degree of the population have as well. And when you get down to the essence of why they're against this trade agreement, is that they feel like a lot of the provisions in it will lose jobs, lose control for the United States. So there's a part of it that, yep, is not moving to the higher level of thinking globally. You're still thinking more nationally. But there's also a part that has a concern over undue influence by corporate setting of the goals. Much of the stuff that seems to have gotten into the trade agreement was set by corporations. And I can see people wanting to say, well, John, Simpaw sounds great, but look at these other times we've tried to come up with treaties and agreements and do things simultaneously, and corporations stepped in and made it all about increasing your profits.
That's right, Mark, but there's a difference, and that is with Simpaw, we citizens get to make the agreement. With TTIP and all these other international agreements, it is governments influenced by corporations who are making the agreements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the whole difference. That's the whole point. And in fact, agreements like TTIP is what we should expect if we citizens don't use something like Simpaw to get into the driving seat here.
Yeah.
You know, there was a famous American politician, I think, who said, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. You know, and that's exactly the situation now. We globally, we have no means to use our votes to drive our politicians towards the kind of agreements and policies that we citizens design and need. That's what Simpol now offers us. Mm-hmm. And without it, you're just going to get governments and corporations setting the global agenda themselves. And that's what TTIP is all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see, why are governments listening? You know, why are they doing this? Why? Because they're desperate to see economic growth restarting. They're desperate to see more business, more growth, more economic growth, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they think that by granting corporations the right to sue governments and giving them all sorts of other completely undemocratic privileges through these agreements, that somehow this will bring economic growth back. But what's really needed, of course, is proper global governance to make sure that, you know, the global economy is properly regulated and that multinational corporations are properly taxed and that tax havens are weeded out. You know, we need those kind of simultaneous policies, but you're not going to get those from governments or corporations because, like I said, they're stuck in their prisoner's dilemma problem. Mm-hmm. You know, only we citizens can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Simpol gives us the opportunity to actually do, not only to develop the policies, but to use our votes in the new way I describe to actually drive our politicians towards that target. You know, we're in control, not the politicians.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I agree with you, but there is a large group of people in the U.S. who feel that our representatives are speaking more for corporate influences, and so
absolutely,
there's almost a necessary. It's almost like we need to bring back control to the citizens, not only for this aspect of instituting Simpol, but or something similar to that, where we're cooperating in a way at the global level. But there's got to be a take back of the government control away from corporations at the local level. Until we do that, people's healthy skepticism that, well, anything we do at an international level that our politicians are playing a part of, as long as they seem to have be influenced by the 1%, the elite, or whatever you want to call them, then they're going to continue to do that. And why should we look at this policy, simultaneous policy process as well?
Well, they may think that, but I think they're wrong, because if you don't use something like Simpol at the international level, mm-hmm. you know, because the thing is, one of the reasons that corporations have such a strong influence over politicians, I mean, I know in the States it's an even more extreme situation because they're funding, very directly funding candidates, but mm-hmm. you know, one of the reasons politicians are so beholden to corporations is because they know that corporations can move elsewhere, right? They
right.
know
right.
that if they don't, you know, give them the tax breaks and give them all the rest of it, they can move elsewhere and will move elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, politicians are not, you know, they are not only are they I mean, in the U.S., I know it's a more even worse situation than over here, but politicians are fundamentally beholden to international capital. And, you know, you will only get out of that dilemma through global and simultaneous action, because we are living in a global economy.
Yeah.
You know, there's no getting away from it. So people may say, you know, Simpol sounds unrealistic. It sounds too fantastical, sounds like a fantasy. You know, I would say to them, they are the ones that are living in fantasy land, because they are the ones who have not cottoned on to the fact that we live in a global market.
I hear you.
You know?
Well, one of the other points I wanted to get at, John, was that, you know, I think a lot of people recognize that our corporations are caught in the same sort of system, and that they're motivated too by their whole profit motives, and people might say, well, don't we also need corporations to evolve? And they point at things like John Mackey and Whole Foods, capitalism, and all these efforts to try to evolve our corporate system to be at a higher level. But I think in your book you say that's nice, but it's not enough, and it's not going to get us where we want to go. Why do you feel that?
Well, I don't want to denigrate those efforts, because they are they are valuable and they are valid as far as they go. But what I'm trying to say to people is that we shouldn't be lulled into a false sense of security. Why? Because for two reasons. One is, if you actually ever got two Whole Foods markets companies in the same market, in the same business, or in the same state, in the same city, you know, competing head to head with each other, how consciously capitalist are they going to remain? You know, they won't be able to, because they're going to have to, they'll be competing their ethical standards into the ground. You know, and the other problem with conscious capitalism is that, you know, your competitors these days can be on all over the planet. You know, you might want to be, very ethical, but if your competitor in, Pakistan or Australia or Europe or God knows where isn't, you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is again, you know, we have to realize that, I mean, and the other thing you notice about conscious capitalism, Mark, is that most of the companies that do it are those companies that are just at the top of the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones selling to the public. So it makes sense for them to have that image. Mm-hmm. But what about the 90% of business to business, you know, businesses like mine, where you're just selling to another business, you're not selling to the consumer. And so, you know, in that sort of big, solid 90% part of the iceberg, you don't have the opportunity to actually make sort of consciously capitalist or stakeholder kind of thinking a part of your brand image, because you don't have that in the business to business part of the market. You know, so I think it's a good thing, but I'm saying we shouldn't be lulled into a false sense of security.
Understood. Understood. Now, you know, we're in the midst of a very entertaining and very long presidential campaign over here. And from your observations on the other side of the pond, John, I would probably be remiss if I didn't ask you about your perspective in looking at our current candidates and your out about trying to support this idea of cooperation through the Simpaw process. And you look at our presidential race. What are your thoughts? And do you see any candidate here who maybe is most in alignment with moving us forward in the direction that you think that we need to go?
Well, I think one of the reasons that, and it's not just in the U.S., but one of the reasons politics is getting more and more polarized towards the extremes, both left and right, mm-hmm. is because people don't see mainstream politics as offering any solutions anymore. And they're right. But my point is, why is that happening? It's happening because governments have to keep their national economies internationally competitive. Okay? They have no choice. It doesn't matter who you vote into power. You know, you can vote Bernie Sanders into power. You can vote Donald Trump into power. It doesn't matter. Whoever gets into the White House has to keep the U.S. internationally competitive. What does that mean? It means, oh, we've got to keep our corporation taxes low. Oh, it means we've got to keep taxes on the rich low, otherwise they'll go elsewhere. Oh, it means, in other words, the same old policies. And, you know, I think the biggest mistake we can make is to believe that changing the person in power can actually make that much difference. I'm not saying it won't make any difference, but it isn't going to make the big difference that people expect. It was the same with Obama. Do you remember just before Obama, or when Obama was just voted, elected as president, mm-hmm. you know, people were in raptures Americans I know over here were like, oh, this is just so wonderful, and, you know, and I mean, I know after George Bush, relatively speaking, you know, I can understand it, but you know, what I'm trying to say is that we citizens need to grow up and stop thinking that our politicians are these wonderful parents who will come and save us.
Right.
We've got to grow up and become the parents ourselves, because they ain't going to do it for us. And all the while we think a Bernie Sanders is going to save us or a Donald Trump is going to save us, you know, we are still hiding. We're still hiding from ourselves. We're still in denial. Mm-hmm. So that's one answer. You know, as to the rest of it, I mean, you know, it's quite entertaining, really, when you see the Donald. You
know. I've just got to comment on this, because, you know, what you were just getting at was the fact that the change has got to come from within. It's not going to come from without. And this is a point that my wife and I were talking about your book the other night, and we were having a wise conversation, and she was throwing a lot of scenarios at me as to why she found it unrealistic.
Well, I apologize to you, Mark, for giving you a bad evening.
And I said, well, I'm sure he could defend it better than I'm doing in this conversation. But the point that she ultimately was making with me, and I think is a point you were just making as well, is that a lot of times we look for things out there to be the savior for whatever it is. And it's really about personal responsibility.
I think,
you know, one of the aspects of personal responsibility is taking those personal steps to ensure that our politicians who represent us in national and global policies are speaking to our needs. And that means, at least if nothing else, communicating and voting our conscience and our hearts towards what is right. But the other point I think that she was attempting to make with me, and I think she made it quite well, was that a lot of it is in moving to, you know, when you move to higher levels of consciousness, move to higher levels on spiral dynamics, when you move to second tier consciousness and you see the play of various worldviews that are going on, that are driving a lot of the political stuff right now, that you can get, on the one hand, discouraged by the conflicts and not seeing the way out. But on the other hand, there's an aspect of you that touches into something bigger and greater, that recognizes that you're not as small as you think you are. You're actually part of a one wholeness or a greater connectedness. And it's really at that level, and it's moving into that consciousness that's really going to be moving us to the next level. The more people who can move and elevate their own consciousness to a state of seeing how we're all united.
Yeah, but that's absolutely right, Mark. But I think part of that actually is you know, where you earlier you said, you know, we need to vote people who will look after our interests. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I'm even beyond that, and I think part of this new consciousness is realizing that it's not a question anymore of voting in an ethical person. Mm-hmm. You know, however, I mean, I'm sure Obama is a pretty ethical person, but, you know, whoever that ethical person is still has no choice but to keep the U.S. internationally competitive, mm-hmm. right? So my point is that however ethical our leaders may be, they are stuck in a system which forces them to adopt policies which basically maintain the existing situation. So, it is wrong to think that voting one person or another, I mean, I'm not, you know, of course there are differences between candidates. I'm not trying to say they're all the same. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, whoever we vote in and however good they may intend to be, they are locked into a system which effectively forces them to adopt policies which, you know, are just going to keep the same old situation going.
Right.
And you see, so we've got to actually... The level of political consciousness for me is that we actually get to the point where we say, well, you know, we've actually got to do this ourselves. Mm-hmm. We've got to, instead of voting for different politicians, we need to create our own global policies and then force politicians to compete to support our policy. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what Simpol does. It turns it all the way around.
Yeah.
Turns it around 180 degrees.
Yeah.
That's the new level for me. That's a new level of consciousness, because, you know, the way the world's going, it's, for me, it's a little bit like we're in an airplane and it's veering wildly out of control, you know, and we're sitting in coach class and we're really worried because we think the plane's going to crash. Eventually, one of us gets up and goes down to the cockpit door, opens the door, and to our horror, we find that we think the politicians are in there. They're not. There's no one in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, that's the situation, because the politicians are not in control. They're actually sitting back in first class along with the corporations doing things like TTIP. You know?
Yeah.
And so it's a question of realizing that they ain't going to get us out of this hole. Bernie Sanders, nice though he is, well-intended though he is not going to get us out of this hole. Neither is Donald. Neither is Hillary.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's very scary. That's a very scary thing for people to actually acknowledge. And that's why we prefer to believe in our leaders, because then we can just carry on mm-hmm. not taking responsibility and blaming them instead.
Yeah, there's like a level of stepping into the role of citizen that I think a person needs to move through. And I think that at one level, I'm voting for that person, and they're the one who's going to represent my needs, et cetera. And I think we all need to take that step. But then, and to the degree that they have some sway of what might happen if we vote for Bernie versus Donald, the results on some levels will be different. But as you say, the system itself is rigged such that the system needs to be changed. And that's where I think you're really calling us to step up to a higher level of playing the role of citizen. It's not simply voting.
Precisely.
It is taking that next step to, getting our politicians to support the Simpol policy.
Process. That's right.
It's getting involved in the creation of the policies that we need to implement at a global level, and ensuring voices are heard across the world on those.
That's exactly right.
Changing the system. You know, a couple of final questions here in the last minute or two, John. A lot of people would probably hear this and say, well, where's the United Nations in all of this?
Well, exactly. I mean, you would expect, normally when you talk about things like this, you'd expect the UN to be in the forefront. But what people don't understand is that the UN actually has no power of its own. The only powers that the UN has, the use of force and sanctions, is not actually the UN's decision. It is actually the Security Council's decision. And who is the Security Council? Well, it's the nation states, US, France, Britain, China, Russia. It's the five permanent members of the Security Council. So the UN is kind of a fig leaf for nation states. And that's why, because nation states are all competing, they're all in this prisoner's dilemma, like we said right at the beginning, the UN is kind of, through no fault of its own, can't actually do anything unless the major nations, at least, are willing to do it. So again, you come back to how do citizens get nations to act, and that comes back to Simpol again. So the UN, sadly, is just not it's not configured to deliver the kind of solutions that we need, and it's through no fault of its own. I mean, the UN was designed by nation states. It's not surprising that nation states designed it in such a way that it has no real power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like we need to evolve into something beyond the United Nations, and that's really what
that's right. And I don't think, I don't think the UN is going to bring global democracy to the people of the world. We the people are going to have to bring it to the UN.
It's
going to have to work bottom up, not top down.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, you're just now bringing this more fully into the United States, and we've got listeners out there in the States and many of our Coffee Party members who may say, this sounds intriguing and I'd like to be more involved. What's the next step for those people, and how can they support you and the Simpol process?
Well, I'd urge them to go to our website, simpol.org. You can sign on for free there. There's also a whole load of resources there, including the little short book you just mentioned, Mark, Global Domestic Politics, which you can download You can download it for free. You can email me too. My email address is there. If you've got any questions, there's a big FAQ on the site for all sorts of questions that people have. So it's all there, you know. And I'm not saying that it answers every single concern. What I am saying is that from what I can see and from what people are telling me, it's one of the better ideas out there so far.
Yes, I agree. I think it is a very good idea. Any final comment? Anything I didn't ask you about, John, you'd like to leave with our listeners before we end today?
I think you covered it pretty well, Mark. There are it opens up so many questions and you know, it opens up a whole new area, really. And to me, it's a bit like, getting into Simpol is a bit like what Ken Wilber said about, you know, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get it back in, you know. So it's kind of, once you get it, you're kind of addicted to it. So you can see how simple it is and how powerful it could be if actually just a relatively, you know, a large but actually relatively small number of people get involved in it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you not only for being on the program today, but I want to thank you for responding to your mother many years ago when she asked you that question. and for you for taking all of the steps that you've been doing for the last 16, 17 years now to move the planet forward in terms of higher degrees of cooperation. I encourage all of our Coffee Party listeners to check out the resources and John's website. Download the book and read it. It's a quick and it's an entertaining read, and I think that you'll get some great insights from it. I know that I did as well. And look out, reach out and support the Simpol process. I think that this process is a good step in moving us to higher levels of cooperation among our governments while still maintaining the autonomy and our importance as Americans or whatever citizen of whatever country you're a part of. So thanks again, John.
Thank you, Mark, and thanks for everything you're doing, and thanks again for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. And so we'll be signing off, and until next time, this is Mark Gilbert for Conscious Bridge Radio. So long.